Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Awesome.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
That's
awesome.
Really awesome.
Awesome.
That's, so
that's awesome.
Awesome.
Oh, awesome.
That's
awesome.
With Stephen Bradford.
Stevie B!
Yo, what's up,
buddy?
Yo! Hey, how are you, man?
I'm doing great, dude. How are you?
Yeah. I'm good, dude. The sun's shining. We brought out a slip and slide this weekend.
Oh, you did?
Oh, my God. My kids, I didn't know you had to teach slip and slide technique. I thought it was intuitive. It's not.
No, it's not. If you didn't grow up in our time, it's not at all.
It's not. They run and then they just like fall down and then they don't move. And I'm like, no, you gotta like jump with your arms forward. And they're like, what? Like, I didn't realize that is such a leap of faith to do that. It's scary.
Oh, dude. Do you remember like the ones we would make? Like we had some regular ones, but then we tried to extend it with like garbage cans or garbage bags. And that would never work. That would never work.
No.
At all.
We thought about putting like dish soap on it and stuff, but then our neighbor was like, that's going to kill the grass and that's the HOA. And I was like, all right, nothing. But it was still fun. It felt like summer, you know?
And getting the kids' eyes and freaking burn
eyes.
You're
right.
Eyes
oh, I never thought about that. That's terrible. You're right. So, but it was still fun to have the slip and slide out. And it was nice to be outside.
Yes, for sure. The outside's amazing right now, dude. It's starting to feel like summer. The nights are nice and awesome. And So hopefully, things will relax a little bit and we'll be able to get outside again and, do some stuff.
But in the meantime, while we're cooped up, we're having the best of times. And boy, do we have an incredible guest today.
We do have an amazing guest. He's such an awesome guy. And I'm so excited that he agreed to sit down with two dummies like us.
I mean,
Peter Bergman from The Young and the Restless.
Hey, guys.
Hello, cool. Sir. It's so good to see you.
I know about this podcast. I certainly know you guys. You know, I should start by saying that I have always been a student of daytime television while I've been doing it. So I'm aware of other shows and everything. And Brad, you came up with literally the singular, most interesting, odd, wonderfully quirky, dynamic character that I can remember in daytime. And Steve Burton, I have said for decades now, no one works silence better than Steve Burton.
Well, thank you, Peter Bergman.
That means so much. And I remember the first time you ever said words to me. I remember seeing you and going, oh, wow, that Peter Bergman. And you came up and said something so nice to me. And as a person that was new to daytime, and not really knowing if I had a place, but at least having fun, that coming from you meant so much to me. And it means so much to me now as well, so many years later. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. So I love getting a chance to talk with both of you. Right.
Yeah. So we appreciate it, Peter. And you've always been a great guy. And we'll get into that. But where did it all start? Where are you from?
So I was a Navy brat. I grew up moving all over the place. Every 2 years we moved. So until by the time I was in 10th grade, I had lived in 10 places.
Wow.
Did any of those 10 places register more than others?
Some did. I was born in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I have no memory of that, but I am fascinated with all things Cuban. And maybe that's just, I don't know. But I love Cuban music. I love Cuban food.
That's cool.
I haven't been yet. Haven't been yet. But we lived in a bunch of different places. But perhaps the one that really stood out was Key West, Florida. My father was an exec, the number two guy on a ship down there. And we lived this Tom Sawyer existence. You were so free to do everything. As a second grader, my fourth grade brother and I would take our dimes and we would drop them in the slot on a little VW bus that took us downtown. And we'd go to a movie downtown, two little kids, and nobody worried about us. It was crazy. It's how I learned to sail. My friend Denny, another second grader, his parents had a sunfish, and so we took it down to the water and shoved it in and figured out how to get back
into the ocean.
And now I've been yeah, into the ocean. I've been sailing all my life, and that's where it started.
I don't know if I'd let my second grader into the ocean with a sailboat and say good luck to you.
That one parents didn't really know about until we were pretty good.
Well, that time too, parents didn't know anything we were doing as kids.
That's right. That's right.
Well, because that could have ended up being your next trip to Cuba.
It could well have been to Cuba. Yeah. 90 miles away, a short hop.
Yeah.
So we moved around every couple of years, and so if you guys have any friends from elementary school that you've known all your life, I don't have any of those.
And was every city a port of call for
every city was a port of call, but for Washington D.C., where my father headed up the experimental diving unit in Washington D.C. on the Potomac.
Wow.
But everything else was shore driven.
Yeah. So Dad would sail off for a bit.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had a number of times where Dad disappeared for 6-7 months to go to a trip to Europe, or when we lived in San Diego for a couple of years, two trips to the Western Pacific. My mom had a tough job. Yeah. So I have siblings too. So I've got an older brother, a younger brother, and a baby sister. Mm. And my mother was in charge of everything for months at a time.
Oh, so Peter, gosh. when did your dad, when was he able to, did he retire?
So he retired from the Navy when I was probably at the very end of high school. He worked in the private sector for a while and then worked for the Department of the Navy in Washington, D.C. for the rest of his career. Wow, so man. Yeah, he put in a lot of years with the Navy.
Man. Did you and your siblings have any, did you guys play together with Dad gone and Mom trying to wrangle it? What kind of growing up was that like with your family? Because I imagine if you're changing city every 2 years, your mom never really had a lot of help either because there was no roots there.
I think that the nature of that kind of life is it throws kids together.
Yeah.
You've just been somewhere for 2 years. You developed all these friends and everything, and your parents tell you one night, "Hey, say goodbye to everybody and grab your stuff, and we're going off to live somewhere else." So we get to the new place, and all we had was each other. And it's funny, today we are very, very close, all four of us, very close. Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, my older brother and the youngest sister live in the same town in coastal California, Los Osos, San Luis Obispo area.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And my brother John and I, who shared a room our entire childhood, are very close. I talk to him all the time.
Your high school years, where were those spent?
High school years were in Washington, D.C., or Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., called Camp Springs, Maryland.
Camp Springs, Maryland.
Yeah. Is that when you kind of got into the arts in high school, or did?
My story of becoming an actor was really a chasing girls story.
We hear this a lot.
We talked with James Reynolds last week, and his transition into acting was in college looking for the girls.
So I was in high school. I was an athlete. I played a number of sports, and athletes didn't go anything in the drama department or anything. But there was a girl, Margot Knight, who was hanging out after school auditioning for a play. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm auditioning. You want to audition?" I said, she said, "No, come on, audition." And it was kind of a little dare. And I said, okay. And they were doing Peter Pan. And it had how tall are you? I said I was, 6'8" and 300 pounds. And what role are you reading for? I put Captain Hook, because I remembered that character in Peter Pan, the Cyril Richard version that used to show on television once a year. And Margot took my thing and wrote after Captain Hook, only Captain Hook.
Oh.
And handed it in. And so I went in there and made a total fool of myself. The first thing they want to see was if you could move around. And so they just kind of put on some music. And he said, just move around. I just want to see your, you know, how loose you all are. And in a short time, I was dancing around. Three people I had walked in with were standing against the wall snickering. And they didn't get called back, and I did. And one thing after another, all they had me read was Captain Hook. And then I had to go one night, and they were really winnowing it down. The drama teachers explained to me that he had gone to the teacher's lounge and said, I got this weird situation. I got this guy who's actually pretty damn good, but he's not any part of our department. And the big roles, you know, you give to your own people.
Of course.
But I think this guy's good. They said, what's his name? And he said, Peter Bergman. And they all said, nah, it's a bit of trouble. You know, I don't think that. So I went on a weekday night to this a callback, and I read, let me see if I can remember the words. How still the night is. Nothing sounds alive. Now is the hour when all children in their homes are abed, their lips bright brown with the goodnight chocolate, their tongues drowsily searching for belated crumbs housed emptily in their swollen cheeks. I was dazzled. I thought this was the coolest thing in the world to get to talk like that. And so I laid it on as thick as I could, and they cast me in that role.
Wow.
And
I'm dazzled right now.
I mean,
they were crazy words. It was just so much fun.
Yeah.
And I look around the room, and there are all of these girls who are pretty who I don't know because they're in the drama department.
Sure are.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah. So yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, and what a great role to be able to kind of, if you felt that freedom and you enjoyed that kind of escape into another world, that role can be like foppish. It can be outlandish. It can
exactly.
be anything you want it to
exactly.
be. And that,
in fact, the more outrageous, the better. And
absolutely.
In fact, So taking an 11th grade guy who's, you know, cool is a very important thing to 11th grader, and trying to convince him that the farther you go, the happier you'll be, was a joint job between the director, the teacher, Mr. Messina, who died last year, and Margot Knight, who I'm still in touch with.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when that experience culminated, were you like, more please?
I was a perfectly mediocre student. I was a good student. I was just a lazy student. Suddenly I was interested in school. I was, you know, if you didn't have good grades, you didn't do plays after school. You know, I mean, you need to keep up with school. So I suddenly became a very, very good student. And I made all kinds of new friends. And I was kind of a fence walker. Actually, Steve's worked with me before. I straddle the fence pretty well with all different kinds of people, in part because I grew up in the military, and in part because that's how I had to live my high school years after that, because there were a lot of people that did not understand what I was doing. What are you doing in plays?
So Peter, did the play, did the acting ignite a different passion for you than sports did? Because obviously you played a lot of sports.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
So it set something off.
It set something off. It was creative, and I hadn't fully allowed myself to think, oh, there's an avenue to go down. I was a good reader. I was aware of fiction and the world of imagination, but I'd never kind of applied it to me. And suddenly I had all of this impetus to stretch myself. And I really dug that. I really liked that a lot.
Did the tribal atmosphere of the company, was that a really welcome thing for a kid that was kind of wandering around for his whole youth?
I really had to. I I actually had to earn my place in this tribe in a big way for the reasons I explained earlier.
Sure.
Normally, there's a drama department, and when they found out they were doing Peter Pan, there were three guys who said, maybe I'll do Captain Hook, maybe, you know. And suddenly this steps in and is you know, gets the role. And yeah, I had to earn my stripes with that group too. But they were just smarter than a lot of the athletes. They were just smarter people, and I liked that. They were brighter. They were clever.
Curiosity too.
A sense of curiosity. Exactly right. Which, going back, 11th grade athletes, curiosity and a sense of wonder is not a huge part of that picture.
Yeah, to kind of piggyback on Bradford's question, because it was a good one. Were you hesitant to get close to people in school every time you would move around?
No. Actually, it was harder on my older brother to meet new friends and things like that.
It would be,
That is something that if there was one great thing that came of my moving all the time, is I got very good at meeting people. I have strong skills in that department.
I went to 5 different high schools. So,
okay. So you know what I'm talking about.
So, you know, you could either be, you gotta adapt and meet people, or are you just going to be reclusive? You know,
so here's high school was a little more civilized this way. One of the difficult things about moving every couple of years is I was a big kid. I've been this big since I was in 11th, I mean, in 8th grade.
Wow.
I was a big kid. So a big kid comes into a new school, and there are a couple tough guys in school who decide, oh, big guy thinks he's tough guy too.
Mm, sure.
Well, no, I didn't say that. I just got here.
No.
And you had to learn to take care of yourself in that world too. And that was just a part of it all. You had to, I don't want to be tougher than you. And then the shove, and then
they were like, we're going to mess this guy's hair up right now, I swear.
Right, yeah. and you know what that does to me, Steve.
I know,
yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, you too. Me too. Exactly.
So when high school graduation rolled around, what was your first instinct, to chase something in the arts, or was it something else?
No, you know, I still hadn't gotten my act together, and I spent a whole year working for a research company in Arlington, Virginia. A neighbor helped me get the job. I wasn't sure I wanted to go to college. I didn't know really what I wanted to do. So I would call that a year of foundering more than really just a year of discovery.
And there wasn't any pressure to go to the academy or anything like that?
There was no pressure to go to the academy. I went to a community college the following year near me, and with no intention of being involved in the drama department. I was going to be an English major, and I was on campus, and there were signs up for auditions for a show called Celebration.
Schmidt and Jones.
Yeah, Schmidt and Jones. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I had gone to a thespian competition as a high schooler and done very well, and got this big award for the thing that we did from Anne of a Thousand Days. And we went one night to see another high school did a production of Celebration. And the guy who played Potemkin, kind of the narrator of the whole thing, was so good. I thought, this guy's a lot better than I am. How did I win this? This is wrong. This guy is very good. It stuck with me. It really bothered me. So I'm in college, just getting my thing started, and I see this thing for Celebration, and I think, you could prove to yourself that you're every bit as good as that guy was. Wow. See if you can go get the role of Potemkin.
Hmm.
And so I did that. And while I was in that production, which was a real success for me, I have no idea if I was as good as that guy. That guy was very good. But a castmate, a guy named Tim Van Pelt, said, I'm going up to New York to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I'm going to audition. I said, cool. I'll go with you. And he said, well, I mean, to audition? I said, sure. Yeah. Whatever, you know? So I contacted the Academy and they sent this audition booklet. Here's some ideas. And there were a couple of good ones in there. And I thought, I like this. So I learned these couple of monologues. And Tim and I went up there and went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. It was the first time I had been in New York City. I wasn't.
All the other places you'd been, but not there.
Yeah, I'd been to a lot of places, but I'd never been to New York City. And I went there, and from the moment I stepped off the train, completely dazzled by everything I saw. It's so much bigger than me. Loved it. This giant life going by left and right. And I went to the Academy, and the first piece went very well. And the second piece, which was full of wonderful language, it was a Chekhov a piece called The Boar. And it was a dressing down of somebody in rather a large language. And so I thought I would show off my comfort with language and did a rather grand and presentational delivery of the thing. And when it was over, one of the heads of the American Academy said, "Peter, quick question. Did you have a chance to read this play?" I said,
"Oh no!
I'm going to be honest with you. No, I didn't." He said, "Oh, okay, I didn't think so." He said, "Okay, this role, and particularly this moment in this role, this is the boar, and he is a boorish, ugly, loud, crude man. And you have made him such a noble gentleman that I had a feeling maybe you were so anyway, I thought that's the end of this. Well, damn, that was a good adventure. And I still got in, and he said, that was two amazing years of my life.
Yeah,
that was, those were amazing years. That was a whole world opened up to me. I had lived in the military and traveled to all of these rather provincial places, and I went to the greatest city in the world and figured out how to make this work with my friend Tim Van Pelt, who's still a friend, who's still a part of my
life. Oh good, he got in too.
Yeah, he got in too. and he did exceedingly well there.
Okay, good.
And it was a giant victory for me. And surviving New York City was a giant victory. We lived on 11th between B and C. New York City was fantastic for me. The American Academy of Dramatic Arts was this old building designed by Stanford White, who's a very famous character in New York architecture and died in a murder in New York City. It just opened the whole world for me. I thought New York was I still think New York is the greatest place in the world. And I got introduced to it, and after the Academy, I had an agent. Agents came and saw performances and everything.
Isn't that amazing?
And the agent sent me out on a few things that I got, but nothing that really turned into anything. And I switched agents and started doing theater, regional theater, and getting out to do things. And I'd make enough money to save up to pay rent while I was gone and have a few months of rent when I got back before I'd have to start waiting tables again.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
And I did a few years of that. And then one day I had three auditions in one day. I had a commercial audition, totally forgettable. A bunch of guys that looked exactly like me on a sweaty summer day, early summer. And I was in a suit and sweating before I even got there. And then I had a theater audition that I really wanted.
Yeah.
A new Tennessee Williams play. He hadn't done a play in 18 years. It was called Vieux Carré. And they were going to do it in New York. And they wouldn't let the script out.
Yeah.
I went, I went to the York Theater. I sat backstage read it the day before. And then I went back that day early after I went with my suit folded up in a bag and different clothes on for this. And I read it over and over again and saw the size for my role and went out. And it was being directed by Jose Quintero, very famous director who directed most of the Tennessee Williams plays on Broadway, including Brando in Streetcar. So anyway, I'm auditioning for Jose Quintero. I am right for this role. And from the moment I step on stage, it could not go more wrong. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Oh,
and,
man.
And after I'm still trying to, you know, get it going again, I hear a very soft voice from the audience say, "Thank you." And I left. And I was thunderstruck.
Isn't it amazing how thank you can be like the worst words to hear in an audition? When they say thank you, you know it's over. It's the worst feeling.
It was so polite and it was so definitive. It was the end of this dream. Okay. So I went home. My agent never followed up on auditions. And she calls me and says, "Hey, how did the Tennessee Williams audition go?" I said, "It was awful. I was awful. You should get rid of me. I'm not a good client. This was awful. It was terrible." She said, "Well, don't forget, you had that All My Children audition later today."
Oh, man.
Now, at this point, I knew nothing about soap operas. And I'm a New York theater snob. And I'm thinking, "Oh, why did I agree to this?" Ricky had told me, "You know, go. You know, this is a lot of actors do this between gigs. Go, get this role on All My Children." Had she not called, I would never have gone. It was an audition I almost didn't go to, and I went, and one thing turned into another, and you know how these things go, you know.
Yeah. Well, you were probably
just short enough, or just blonde enough, or just dumb enough. To perfect for the role they had in mind,
right?
And the rest is just crazy history.
Well, that day of gearing yourself up for that theater audition, and then being so crestfallen afterwards, you didn't go into that. The way you walked into that room, that day set you up for the victory in that room a little bit, probably, right?
It did in this sense, and you're both actors, and you'll know what I mean. I didn't care.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, you had such a letdown earlier. Yeah. You're like, whatever. I'm just going to go do this. And
whatever.
It is
I'm just
going to
do this. And it freed me. And I was as loose as I was going to be. If I don't get this, I don't get this. Whatever. You know.
Well, and that's the thing.
I'm here because I told Ricky I'd be there.
That energy of not caring. That like. I don't need this is the sexiest energy there is.
Exactly right. Exactly
right. I don't need you.
Exactly. In the same way, desperation is this giant turnoff for everyone, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, what did your family think about you going, like when you decided to go to the American Academy, was your family all gung-ho for it? Or what was that like?
I think they were happy that I found some real direction. I think my parents were concerned. And my father, of course, had to drop Tim and I off at 11th between B and C, and this was the one image I have, Brad, of me pulling up to the apartment that Tim had found for us on a trip up by himself. I was working construction with bricklayers, trying to make enough money to pay for the American Academy and have some money for New York City and everything. And he took a trip up there, and he found this apartment that he said had an Oriental garden in the back. Well, yeah, it was the thieves' entrance to our apartment was what we came to think of it as. But it was on 11th between B and C. My father pulled in the car, and the one image I have is as we're coming to a stop, a big long fluorescent bulb. Some kid, probably 5 years old, throws it, and it explodes right in front of our car. Welcome to New York City.
Wow.
And my dad thinks I'm letting my kid off in hell and then driving back home.
My senior year of NYU, I lived on 14th between in Stuyvesant Town. Do you know Stuytown?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I lived there my senior year of college.
Some of those were pretty big apartments too.
They were great. Yeah. And so for college seniors, I mean, it had a beautiful kitchen and it was a great apartment and had like these gardens that you could walk through. I mean, it was a beautiful part of town and hard to get. Like the only way you could get them is if somebody died.
I'm amazed that you got into Stuyvesant Town. Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. So we should have held on to it. We only stayed there for a year, but I love that part of town. That part of town was so great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, now you know the Alphabet Land and all that very hip and everything.
Yeah, it's a different world. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But the All My Children thing happens, and I think, well, you know, this is what happens to everybody who's in daytime television or has ever been in daytime television. So I go about the work, and what I didn't realize is this is the beginning of the crest of the wave. Suddenly, I'm looking everywhere, and they asked me to be on the cover of People Magazine. People Magazine? Daytime on People Magazine?
Yeah, hold on. Peter, what character did you play on All My Children?
I played a guy named Cliff Warner. He was a doctor. He was a resident when the show first started. And it was this kind of gothic romance, a rich girl, Nina Cortland, and her very possessive father move into town, and she falls for the local surgeon who's finishing his residency, and the father cannot stand this guy. He was played by James Mitchell, a formidable actor, a wonderful human being, who had already had a whole career in dance. A very famous dancer. If you ever saw the movie Oklahoma, he danced the Dream Curly role in Oklahoma. He was one of Agnes DeMille's main dancers. And he was in Mac and Mabel on Broadway, and he was in Carnival on Broadway. So I walk in at 26 years old at the same time this 60-year-old man who has been chewed up and spit out by this business five times.
Sure.
And I'm looking over him and I'm realizing, oh, I should be taking this more seriously.
Yeah.
And he was the greatest example for me. It was just wonderful. I could not take it anything but seriously with him in the room.
So Peter, that's a good point you made, because I was going to actually ask you about this, because you're such a consummate professional, probably one of the most professional people I've ever worked with, and kind and compassionate. And being in the business so long, usually there's someone or something that happens to make somebody go that way or go the other way.
Right.
So it's interesting. So was James kind of your first, like, oh, that's this should be
James
done.
James was the first. James was just this wonderful example. And then after I'd been there for a few years, David Canary shows up. And David Canary also had had a full career before he got to us. And he came in and played twin characters.
Yeah, Adam and something else, right?
Yeah, right. Adam and Stewart.
Yeah.
And the two of them, it was fascinating to watch.
He's amazing.
He was just an amazing actor. Yeah. Kind as could be to everyone. Unimpressed with all he'd done. He just wanted to do the work. Let's just do the work. I just want to run lines with you again. Let's do it one more time. I had great examples, and so I thank you for your compliment. But I want to. That's who I want to be in this company. I want to be one of those guys. Yeah. I want to be one of those guys.
You definitely set the tone. And I think every show has that guy, and I'm glad you're him, because
I'm very grateful to hear somebody say that.
Well, obviously I knew you before, but I didn't really get to know you until I was on the show, and you know, to see how much you were there for everybody after all this time is very inspiring. You know, you were always there. No matter what, let's run lines. You got questions. Let's talk about it. Let's, you know, that's not, it, that doesn't happen often. And that's, yeah, and that's why you're awesome.
Well, one of two things, maybe I'm just not easily bored. Maybe I'm actually a boring person who stays there just for the whole thing. But I have figured out a way to make every single script that I have, there's something interesting in there. There's something, there's some challenge that I can make for myself, some words that aren't working for me that I gotta make these work, or some, there's nothing really happening here. What can we tell people in this scene?
Yeah.
And yeah, I love to run lines because I figure, you know, we're doing it so fast now that, I don't want to go out there and guess. I want to go out there with a real clear idea of what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And so, if that's really important to me, I'll go to you. I'll come to your dressing room and I'll knock on your door and I'll run lines. And yeah, I have been there for a while. So people are a little surprised that I do that. But that makes it all the more effective. It's easier to do that. When you are the guy they expect to be, standoffish and I got my own stuff, I'll take care of me.
Right. So how long were you on All My Children for? How long was that run?
All My Children was 10 years.
Wow.
10 years. Yeah. Yeah. 10 years. And to say we rode the crest of the wave, it was crazy. I mean, yeah. Elizabeth Taylor's on General Hospital, Carol Burnett's coming to do regular visits to All My Children. Show up at a mall and thousands of people show up.
What year?
1979 to
1989. Woo!
Oh, yeah.
Crazy. It was literally, and the numbers, the ratings numbers were insane. All of America was coming out of the closet. An entire generation of college-educated people were scheduling their classes around soap operas.
So cool.
Yeah.
And again, while you're in it, you assume this is the way it's always been. So I wasn't feeling like, wow, aren't we the coolest thing? I just assumed the guy that came before me probably got the same thing.
And he just handed the baton, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, this was the crest of the wave. This was a daytime as a just a monster. And I would travel with a bunch of ABC people. So Taylor Miller and I would run into Tony and Jeannie, and we'd do these shopping malls and stuff. And I've known Tony for a really long time. And we've been friends for a long time.
Well, being in New York is quite an experience when you're a public figure too, right? Because I mean, there's nowhere you can go that isn't around other people. And so that in itself is a different experience than and someone in LA probably at the same time.
Well, right now you can go somewhere. I said, right now you can go somewhere.
You can run naked through New York. Yeah.
Yeah, you can go pretty much anywhere you want right now. Yeah. No, in New York City, it was this giant gift. So New York is tough for a lot of people. Everybody's moving fast. Nobody's making eye contact and things like that. I'm walking around the same city in 1981, and every 10th person looks at me and gives me that, oh, I know who you are, smile.
Right.
In New York City.
Right. That's crazy. Better that than the, I want a piece of you right now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. 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 That was definitely preferable. But that had never happened to me before. And so I saw a side of New York City that was unbelievable. And yeah, you know, you remember you lived in New York City. I could suddenly afford theater tickets. So I had a theater agent, a theater ticket agent, Stan, and I would call Stan and I would say, okay, I just saw this thing in the Times this morning. I'd like to get two tickets for maybe Thursday, you know, and he'd say, okay, let me look. Okay, there'll be a will call and I'd get a bill at the end of the month for my theater tickets.
Oh, that's and awesome.
I used to go see everything. And again, I'm at work with James Mitchell, who's saying, do you ever go to dance? Do you ever see any dance in town? Because this is the capital of dance in this country. Let me take you. So I would go with James Mitchell to the Joyce Theater downtown, go to Lincoln Center. We go to see the ballet once in Lincoln Center, and they're stunning seats. And I said, James, how'd you pull this off? He said, I have friends.
I got a guy, his name's Stan.
We go in, sit down, and we're waiting for the show to start, and there's some commotion. Somebody knows James behind him. He says, Peter Bergman, Jerry Robbins, Peter Bergman. Jerome Robbins was his friend who got him these seats.
Wow. That's some clout.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was crazy. It was crazy. So I had this remarkable life in New York City.
Did you ever in the midst of that 10 years have an urge or an opportunity to do a show in New York? Or were you so written so heavily you just didn't have the chance?
I got to be part of a company that produced five Shakespeare plays in 4 years. And I was a founding member of the company, and we did that. And I'd get my soap opera friends to put money into them and things like that. And
sweet.
You know, help us get this thing going, and I was shameless about that, and so, you know, all my soap opera friends would support us and make it happen. And Stanley Tucci was in that group, and who else was in that group? A few people who were working a bunch were in that group, but for me it was a giant experience.
Because in New York, and if you're living in Manhattan and you're working in Manhattan, there's so many opportunities for other creative outlets, and the people that I knew coming out of college that were doing soaps, I knew a couple of people on One Life to Live and a guy on All My Children, and I was like, wow, those jobs seem amazing, because you know they can still do a show at night most of the time if they want to.
Yeah.
And also they were the ones making the most money at the time, because they had a TV job, and at that point I didn't see myself leaving New York. So I was like, wow, if only I was good looking enough to be on a soap opera, that'd be cool. but it wasn't just that; it was the fact that it wasn't. Those jobs weren't looked at as compared to other TV jobs like they are in LA and New York. Jobs are jobs, right?
And, jobs are jobs. Exactly right.
And that's the way it is becoming now. But when I came out of college in the early 2000s, it didn't feel that way. So, but in New York, those jobs were some of the best jobs you could get. And I just remember identifying that. And then now that I've been in it, thinking about what it must have been like, you know, in the 80s and 90s, And the opportunities, and not only just to do, you know, great high profile things, but also have the outlet from your day to day work playing the same character for however many years, but then having the outlet for all these other opportunities to play around with your creative friends.
It was great. It was a normal part of your day on a soap opera. Oh, so-and-so has a curtain, so we got to get out of here. So we're changing the order of things to get her out, because she's got to make a curtain. It was a very common thing on a soap opera, and it was very cool.
I imagine that affected the company of actors that you're working with in All My Children. When all of them are used to that kind of work and used to that kind of stimulation, did that keep the work fresher at All My Children too?
It did. It absolutely did. So a couple of things would go on. So you have a judge come in to do a story arc that lasts, you know, 10 shows. They hired Phil Bosco to do it. They had a jail thing that Erica's in jail, Susan Lucci's in jail, and Allison Janney comes in and she's her cellmate.
Wow.
And the second week I was there, Maureen Stapleton came in to do a little thing. Carol Burnett was supposed to be on our show at one point, because she'd been on it a few times, and they'd written it all, and she called right before to say her husband had had a stroke. Oh. Joe Hamilton was her husband at the time, and she's going to have to stay here. I can't come, and they scrambled, and I came to work, and I had scenes with Carol in this particular round, and I come to work, and there is Gwen Burton to play the role, and she's a theater legend. I think she has four Tony, yeah. So anyway, she died a couple years ago. So I can tell the story that Gwen Verdon was terrified of doing a soap.
Of course.
No rehearsal. Oh my God. She went out of her mind. She went out of her mind. We were talking her off a cliff left and right. But these were the kind of people. And then you'd go to the makeup room and everyone's talking about the show they saw last night. And it was, so when I came to California to do this show that saved my life, my job and all my children came to a very sudden end, very unexpected. A number of things happened at exactly the right time, exactly the wrong time. A new executive producer, new head writers, no real allegiance to history of the show and characters and everything. And I was off the show and my wife was pregnant with our second child. And we just bought the apartment next door and broken through, and life in New York was perfect. And I was probably going to be there forever. And suddenly I was without a job on daytime television. And I'd love to tell you, I was strong enough to, oh, just pick yourself up, dust yourself off, go get another job. I'd been there long enough that I was thunderstruck.
I can imagine.
Thunderstruck.
Wow. And and how long was that time before the phone rang? Or did the phone ring?
So this is my most embarrassing story as an actor is this. They told me in June that my last day would be in September. I'd spent most of June pretty darn depressed. And I kept getting, my agent would call to say, we keep getting calls from The Young and the Restless. What do you want to do about this? And I wasn't sure I wanted to do another soap right away. I was still just heartbroken from this whole thing. Still working on a soap. I was still doing all my children to the end of this contract. And then I got another call and Alan said, they called to ask how tall you are. How tall I am. I don't even call them back. How tall am I? You want to give me a role? Great. If you don't, that's fine too. But how tall am I? Come on. So eventually my resolve weakened as I was getting closer to the end of my job, and Young and the Restless kept calling. They had been looking to replace a character, Jack Abbott, who had been played by Terry Lester for 10 years.
Wow.
And to great achievement. He was a very well-respected actor, a very popular character. And on All My Children, replacements didn't work. It never turned into anything. It never, just kind of didn't work. So I didn't want to be a replacement of any kind.
Sure.
I wasn't sure I wanted to do another soap, and I did not want to move to Los Angeles.
Right. That must have, because New York was, that was home.
My last day of All My Children came. They rolled out a cake. Said goodbye, speeches, tears. Mary Ellen's there, big as a house with the baby inside. And we walk home to get ready to fly to Los Angeles. I'm going to fly the next morning. Mary Ellen's due in the next 2 weeks. Wow. I'm going to fly to Los Angeles and audition for this show, Young and the Restless. And I went there and the audition went quite well. I did an audition with Jess Walton and Jerry Douglas, the guy that played my father.
Yep.
And they were supposed to let me know in a week. And the next day in New York, I got a call from Ed Scott, the executive producer, saying, we got a brand new kid at home and I know how uncomfortable it must be for you. We want you and your agent's supposed to tell you, but I'm telling you, you got the job.
Oh, so that's awesome, dude.
So it meant the end of New York City. So Mary Ellen and I are together with the phone call and I wept like a baby. Yeah.
At what point in the process of the audition did you turn to be like, you know what? I do want this. Or was it not till you got it that you made peace with it?
I think every actor can identify with this, that, you don't really want it. You've seen that show. You're not really interested. And then you get the script and, oh, it's not very good. And then you start memorizing it and you realize, oh, there's something to play here. And then a little more time goes and you keep working on it and you decide, no, I like this script. I'm actually, I can do this. And before you get there, you desperately want it. And this was something you thought you didn't want at all. Yeah.
Well, because it's a judgment on your talent too, right? If you prepare for it, you want to be validated by getting it. Even if the fallout from getting it is something that maybe isn't something that you're looking forward to that much, but of course I want them to want me. Gosh.
Yes, exactly. So I got to kill this audition, and it went very well. It really did. And we had to undo this charmed life we lived in New York City and start work there. So here's the answer to your question. My contract went to October. My last day was the beginning of September. They had to pay me through October. And so there were 8 days between the end of All My Children and the beginning of The Young and the Restless that I was completely without a salary.
8 days.
That's boo-hoo.
They were 8 tough days, Steve.
Yeah, I'm sure they were, buddy.
They were 8. I mean, no money coming in at all. No job.
Two apartments in New York and no money.
Did you put the wall back up?
No, sold it as a one big unit.
Man, can you imagine if you had that now?
They call those a double wide, right?
Oh, if I had that now. That's like a double lot, exactly. Yeah. It's like a double lot out here. No, we joined the apartments together, and we held on to it for 7 years. Beautiful. I was out here paying for a house, paying for 2 apartments in New York, because as soon as this job's over, I'm headed back to New York City.
Oh,
I am getting out of here. Oh, I am.
You were holding on to it for when you move back.
And eventually, they'll figure out that I'm not that good, and they'll this will come to an end, and I'm going right back to New York City. And then enough years went by, and sublets, and I used to sit on the co-op board, and the board called me and said, Peter, we can't do this. It's supposed to be owner occupied. You've been renting it out for a while. You got to stop. You got to sell your apartment or move back here. And so that's how it came to an end. But you're right. If I had that apartment today, oh my gosh, what an apartment.
You started Young and the Restless,
1989. Yeah. October 89.
Wow.
And literally, This is, I'm embarrassed to tell you this, dragged, kicking and screaming to the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. Good for you.
I was such a New York snob. What am I doing in this vacuum of creative nothingness? What am I doing here? I can't stand this. And the work was different and everything was different and everything. And today, had the same thing happen to me, the first day I would have bought a surfboard. My second day there, I would have bought a set of golf clubs.
Yep.
And I would have embraced life in Southern California the day I got here. And it took me 7 years to make it a good thing.
It's funny talking about your first experience at All My Children with James and the kind of person that you looked up to. Did you end up being petulant on set, or were you still your best behaved person at work?
Oh, no. I was my very, very best behaved person. I was, when your job comes to a sudden end, you think, could I have done something differently? Did I lose the job because I didn't take this seriously enough, or I didn't do enough of that? So when I got to Young and the Restless, I was determined no one is going to have anything negative to say about my efforts in making these scenes work. I still kind of have that burden today. I do not want to ever look back and think again, because that's an awful feeling. Maybe I could have done more. Maybe I should have done this.
In a way is a gift, though, right? Because
it is a gift. It's a huge gift. Yeah,
it's a huge gift. And it was interesting, Peter. Now that we got to hear the story about your theater background and how kind of ingrained that is in you. The question all the time I got was, what was the difference between General Hospital and Young and the Restless? And, you know, obviously different cast, different show, whatever, new experience for me. But for me, it seemed, I did a little theater, not as much as you or Bradford, but it seemed almost like a theater group that I was going into at Young and the Restless, because everybody was always kind of communing in the open spaces and looking for people to run lines and, hey, let's run it again and let's do this. And there was a lot of excitement about the material, you know, whether it was great or not, because we all go through those times where it's not great and it is great. But that was the difference for me. Maybe it was me coming in with a new perspective on a new character and excited, but that was the difference there. You know, at GH, people kind of keep to themselves. We do run our lines, but, you know, the environment there was so, you know, the fact that there was other shows being shot, there was just such a different energy there. Coming out of your dressing room, you were like, you're walking into energy. You know, as soon as you walk out of your room, there's other stuff going on. You got to watch out for the boat going by from The Price is Right.
Peter, what's up, man?
You know, and it's like, it was this thing where it was so exciting, but it felt like, because there's probably four or five of you guys over there who love to run stuff a lot. And that's what was great. Christian LeBlanc is that guy.
Yep.
You know, we'd always run our stuff into the ground, and it was so fun and so much like a theater group. And now, you know, whether you consciously or subconsciously meant to do that, it kind of happened.
This is my favorite thing you've ever said to me, Steve. This is my favorite thing I've ever heard out of your mouth, that you would describe Young and the Restless that way, because it was not that way when I got there. And I am so grateful to hear that, because that's a dream for me, that we have created an environment that makes actors feel like they're part of something theatrical.
Yeah, really did.
Well, you used really the word company early on, and the fact that you feel like the group of actors at Young and the Restless is a company.
It was really, really important to me when I first got there, and everyone was off in their dressing rooms, and I came from a place where people were constantly in the hallways running lines and everything. Yeah. And so to get to the point where Steve says something like that about Young and the Restless, that's a giant smile for me.
Awesome.
Over the 30 years at YNR now?
30 years.
Yeah.
30 years. Wow.
Well, I mean, it sounds like awesome. There's been so many positives, but are there any experiences that stand out as ones that, you know, of course will be memorable forever, but for any specific highlights?
You know, I think highlights have been kind of catching up. I remember they stopped and made a big deal of my being there for 25 years, and people spoke, and my wife brought my kids in, and I've always been kind of careful to keep my kids away from show business. I had a lot of friends who really struggled in this business, and if my kids came to me and said, this is what I really want to do, I'd be very supportive. But it's so easy to look at what we do in daytime television and think, God, great. Everybody should be an actor.
Sure. Yeah.
It's not quite like this for most people in show business. And so I never wanted my kids to think that. So I probably to a fault kept them away from things. And here they are in the studio and people are up there talking about me. And I think, oh my God, I didn't realize I had this place in my company. I think I just kept my head down and keep working and be kind to people and reach out and compliment and do things like that. And before you know it, your kids are listening. People say things about you that, it was quite a lovely surprise. Oh my God. Wow. I actually have an important place in this company. And I'm not sure I ever felt that. It had to be told to me.
You know, obviously in New York, you had a lot of outlets. 30 years of playing that same character in LA. How did you look for those same kind of creative outlets when you weren't in Television City?
No, it was harder. It was harder because I worked a lot more here and longer hours. And so rehearsal was difficult. We also had small children by the time we came out here. Claire was 4 weeks old. Connor was 3 years old. And so our lives were about that. Sorry, honey, now I'm finished with this work. Now I'm going to go to rehearsal for.
Right. It doesn't fly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, frankly, I have no excuse, but I haven't done that.
Yeah. Well, it's also makes more sense why you didn't pick up any golf clubs or surfboards in those first 7 years.
That's right. Yeah,
after you work a full day on TV, it's hard to be like, hey, I'm going to go hit the links. Good luck with the kids.
Yeah. And in LA, you don't always live close to the studio either.
That's right. That's right.
You know, so you have to take in the commute because you.
I walk to the studio at all my children. I would ride a bike or take a bus or just down Columbus Avenue. No, you're right. That's a good an hour and a half of your day getting to and from work.
Yeah,
but it seems the way that you approach the work, the days where maybe you look at the script and think to yourself, this is not going to be a stimulating day. You don't let that get in the way of doing your best to make it the best it can be.
I just don't. Again, it may be a comment that I'm not that interesting a person, that I don't need that stimulation that much, but I can make something out of nothing. You give me a script. I want to turn this into something. I want to turn this into a scene with pace and different levels and something. Let's play with the pace of it. Let's play with the volume of it. Let's use silence here and there. Luckily I work with people who are open to those conversations.
So what, Peter, we'll wrap up here, but what is it that makes you so grateful? Because that's the one thing I've always noticed about you, and then working with you, to have that, grateful attitude or energy, for 30 years. I mean, what is it every day that you get up and you're like, hey, I'm going to be this guy?
Wow. Okay. I think I spent a lot of my life expecting very little. I think I spent a lot of my young life thinking nothing really great is going to happen to me. I'm slow to say this. I don't want my, it was no way to raise your children, to tell your children, have low expectations. Lower your expectations. That's no way to parent. But it helped me. My expectations were so low. I am so far ahead of where I ever expected my life to be. And that's been true for 40 years. 40 years of doing daytime television. I'm so much further ahead than I thought I would be. Mm. That's what makes me grateful. I'm embarrassed to tell you that, because I'd love to tell a story of somebody who knew who he was and marched into his destiny and I'm not settling for anything less than this is who I'm telling you. I settled left and right, and it turned into a great thing.
Yeah.
It turned into another great thing, and then another great thing. And I am the beneficiary of low expectations.
But it speaks to your character that even through all those things that, as you say, you kind of fell into your lap a little bit. I mean, it was through hard work and all that, but to maintain that sense of being in the present and not looking at your past successes, meaning, just still being present in the awareness of the wonderful things that have happened to you rather than coming to expect them, whatever, that all speaks to your character and it's really lovely.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I'm fighting to prove I deserve all this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, after four Emmys, I think you've proved it.
Awesome. Man. Hey man, what a nice conversation.
This has been literally awesome.
Thank you, brother.
It truly has. Awesome you, is the right word. A delightful Tremendous. Conversation with both of you to get to talk at this length with two guys I admire. I really enjoyed this.
We appreciate you, man. Thank you so much.
So lucky to have you. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, man.
Man, I always knew I've always looked up to him. I've always admired his work and just the way he carries himself. But to learn more about, how that came to be, the influences that he had, and then when you asked him why he was so grateful, I mean, I love where our conversations go with these people, really getting to know people, and not just their experiences, but like what's in their heart. I mean, it's so freaking beautiful.
I know it is. And again, I know we say this all the time. That's why we do this stuff. And
yeah.
And we don't ever really plan things out, which is, which I like. I like that. I like just being able to listen and go where the conversation takes you. And, you know, again, that was unexpected. Like I had that unexpected moment with Brad Maul.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Peter did. And, you know, it was so cool, man. He's just such a good dude. I love the guy so much. So
it's funny, you know, some people think when you interview somebody, you come in with a list of questions. And sometimes we have certain things that we want to talk about. But ultimately, we want the conversation to be led by whatever is said. So, you know, we always try to give each person their time to talk, but it is a conversation. And
totally.
And that's what makes it fun for us. So I know it is like an interview, but it's more of a conversation. That's what.
Yeah, it's cool because you know we've had so many great guests, and you know we had James Reynolds on from Days, which was great. And he texted me, he goes, "Hey man, I had such a great time, and I you know once this shelter in place is lifted, I really love to see you and Bradford and go out to dinner," which I thought was so cool.
Yeah, man.
Because now we have a connection with him more than just what it was before, because we've had great respect for each other, but now it's like, hey man, what's going on? Let's go grab some dinner and talk.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you always, when you run into people in the business or in the industry, you know, you end up being acquaintances at best, right? Just because the same questions come up and it's like, you know, and then you have your, you know, 2 minutes with that person and then it's on to the next person. But having these kind of conversations where we get to have the conversations that only friends get to have usually.
Yeah, it's true. I know.
And so that's a really unique thing. So we're so grateful, and we're so grateful to you guys for listening. We had a lot of stuff going on, Stevie.
We do. We have a ton of stuff going on, man. Always. And we just did some 7 questions with some cool people also. So if you haven't checked out our YouTube channel, go check it out. We have 7 questions, more awesome, phone a fan, and we're coming up with a new one, which we're going to be launching very soon here, my friend.
Boy, oh boy. We have some great guests in 7 questions. We had Natalia this week.
Yep.
Last week we had Jason Thompson. We got Josh Swickard on there. We got Chad Duhl. We have some more great ones coming your way. So make sure you subscribe at our YouTube page, because we're putting so much stuff up there. You certainly want to get notified when it comes up, because you don't want to miss it, because it's really fun.
Yeah, we're having fun. Just laughing. Just two dummies trying to laugh and have fun. And here we are.
That's the whole point. So,
you're welcome.
So, and make sure, I know we're always like, do this, go to stonecoldthejackal.com and get on our email list too, because that's a great way. What we're doing now is every week we send out a recap email with all the stuff that we posted. So that's also a way to kind of keep in touch as well. And sometimes we have discounts for merchandise when we announce new club dates, which hopefully we'll be able to do super soon. We put them out there.
Yep.
So anyway, those are just a couple ideas for you to keep in touch with us, because we surely love keeping in touch with you.
Yeah, guys, we appreciate you guys so much. Can't wait to get back on the road and give you hugs.
Indeed.
If we're ever allowed to again.
Or a nice friendly wave from 6 feet away.
Yeah, totally.
Or a nice stiff elbow.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I don't know if you want to do that.
All right, guys, stay safe out there, and we'll be talking to you next week.
Much love, friends.
Hey, I'm Autumn Calabrese, and I have a question for you. How do you do life? I might be a superstar trainer, but I'm also a boy mom, sister, daughter, friend, and entrepreneur. You might think my life is all working out and cooking healthy, delicious recipes, but trust me, there is so much more to it, and this is it. This is all of those real moments you talk about with your family and friends. Ever wonder what else life has to offer? Bring your curious appetite and let's do life together. Subscribe now at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and PodcastOne.com.